You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to Stay Ahead, a Norwegian Business School podcast. Today's episode is a part of the Strategy as Practice series, where theory meets practice and practice meets theory. And today's topic is big and agile organizations. Today, I have the pleasure of having with me Kristin Skogen Lund. Kristin has been the CEO of Schibsted since 1st of December 2018. Her previous position includes Director General of the Confederation of Norwegian Enterprise, what we call NHO, from 2012 to 2018. She was at Telenor between 2010 and 2012 as EVP of the Nordic Region and Digital Services. Prior to that, Kristin spent close to 10 years with Schibsted in several leading roles and the last position as CEO for Aftenposten. She has had leading positions both at Coca-Cola and Unilever. Kristin has also previously served as president of the Confederation of Norwegian Enterprises called NHO, and she has also been a member of board of Ericsson and Orkla. Today, she's a board member of Adevinta, which is a spin-off from Schibsted, and Adevinta, who in 2020 acquired eBay Classified Group, thereby creating the largest online classified group in the world. And I believe Schibsted owns just below 33%. Kristin holds an MBA from INSEAD and a BA from the University of Oregon. And this was the short version. Welcome, Kristin.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Vegard Kolbjørnsrud. He's an associate professor in strategy at BI and senior research fellow at Accenture. His research interest is, among other things, agile and collaborative organizational designs and the impact of AI, that is artificial intelligence, on organizations. He has a PhD in strategic management from BI. Vegard was 16 years with a consultancy firm Accenture, where he advised several institutions, but in particular, institutions within digital media, telecom, and high-tech industry, particularly on strategic management issue. Welcome, Vegard.
Thank you.
My name is Thomas Borgen, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate here at BI. At the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship, and I will be your host today. Kristin, I read an interview with you recently where you said that in your youth you wanted to be a professor, but I can see you changed your mind. What happened?
Yeah, well, I guess I was a bit of a nerdy kid and I was so eager to learn, and I've also had always a strong urge to explain and express myself. So I figured being a professor was the perfect combination for that. And then I don't know what took me, practical life maybe, I'm not sure, but I ended up a bit far from professorhood. But I kept my curiosity at least, so that's a good thing.
Super. Mm. But then I have to ask you, Vegard, you've been 16 years in what Kristin referred as the practical life, and you went into academia. How come?
Well, I found my inner geek and let him out. Basically, I get to be curious as a full day job and get to tell people about what I find, which is the dream job for me. I really enjoy practice as well, and I still am in touch there, and also sort of trying to find this cross fertilization between practice and the research and theory. there, that's where you have me. But I let my geek out and I can't get him in again.
Well, I'm sure this is going to be a good basis for a super discussion. Most of our audience is likely to already know that Schibsted, as the owner of several consumer brands across media, online marketplaces and technology ventures, you own brands such as Aftenposten, Svenska Dagblad, VG, Finn, Blocket, Lendo, just to mention a few. That should be familiar with actually most of our listeners. But how does a company, a size of yourself, a turnover of more than 12 billion Norwegian kroner, more than 5,000 employees, keep the agility and to ensure a continuous innovation across all business areas? So you left Schibsted in 2010, and you came back in 2018. I presume that the group looked very or slightly different because many of your traditional business lines had changed since you were away. But what values, cultures, or other factors did you kind of recognize when you came back, and which one were new ones to you when you rejoined then in 2018?
Good question. And the thing is, it was a bit like coming back to a friend that you have known really well. And then 9 years have evolved and we had both changed, but we were, you know, we were still the same a little bit, you know, that feeling. That's how it was coming back. And there is something about Schibsted that has not changed. And I think that's also the clue to why we have constantly managed to reinvent ourselves the way we have. And it's something almost a bit anarchistic about the organization. It's an organization with a very strong empowerment of people and teams. It's not run strict, you know, it's not a rigid top-down type of organization. A lot of autonomous parts of the organization which operate very independently and are really empowered for their own success. And I think it's combined with a culture of constantly challenging ourselves and the status quo around us. It's not just sort of accepted to have a strong opinion. It's expected. I think that's what's driven us to where we are. And I think that's the real strength of the culture of that organization. And when you ask what had changed, of course, there, you know, it had been 9 years of internationalization and strong development, especially within the marketplaces. So it was a much, much more international company than when I left it.
Very, very interesting. Actually, one of the things you study, Vegard, and also teach, is this kind of optimal organization structure and the empowerment of the employees. I think that was Christian alluded to as one of the her main first points. What's kind of research telling us there, and what's your experience on that area?
First, I think it's interesting to observe. I mean, we've all seen small and agile organizations. I mean, there are lots of them, but finding big ones, and I don't know the inside story to that, but observing that Schibsted has transformed from a very old, which is still it is, traditional media organization into a digital powerhouse, and doing that while staying profitable and growing, which is quite unique. So there are some signs that you have been able to at least, you know, reach that type of agility and innovativeness, I would say. So the challenge is that as organizers, we would like to have both autonomy, which is great for innovation and adaptiveness and these things, and it would like some form of alignment so we can achieve something together that is bigger than the sum of the parts. And often we, you know, organize in a way that to get alignment to sort of and kills the autonomy. I've studied collaborative communities and networks that are there's very little hierarchy. There's a lot of self-organizing. and what I've found is that when you move from a fixed structure as a way of organizing into a set of shared rules of the game and a high degree of transparency, then you can self-organize, because then you can see what the others are doing, who knows what, who is struggling with what, and you can connect across, and you also have autonomy to solve problems locally and share. So, and the transparency is both important for visibility across, but also in terms of when people are seen, they tend to behave. So you don't need all that hierarchical control to make people behave in organizations. And it's also trust inducing. So some of those aspects I would expect to see also in Schibsted to some degree, although I expect also to see a certain degree of hierarchy in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, yeah, you mentioned several things that and even recognize some of the words that you're using, actually. But I would say there is a duality in two dimensions. One is this thing about tradition and disruption, because we, you know, after we spun out of Inta, we went through this process of defining our future state, and we searched for our soul in a way. And we had a very strong discussion, because you had sort of the traditional, you know, 180-year-old media company on the one side and all the values and legacy that comes with that. And then you have this strong disruptor, right? And we started out by sort of making them opposites. And then we finally realized that what makes Schibsted unique is that we are actually the combination of both those. You have many traditional companies and you have many disruptors, but you have quite few companies who manage to be both. And that's the uniqueness of who we are. So it is that duality on that one. And the other thing is, when you talk about the autonomy and the structure, we have defined Schibsted as a foundation where we share things like technology, data, capital resources, human resources, etc., and we are quite sort of structured and disciplined in how we build that foundation for that to work across everything. But then on top of that foundation, you have all the individual companies, and they're very, very autonomous, but they all build from this foundation. And I think that, so there's a duality in that too. There is a common structure, and that's what makes us more than the sum of the parts, right? It is this foundation and the ability to, for example, share data across, which makes us, able to provide much better products in each autonomous brand and offering. But those are very independent again.
Right.
Yeah.
It sounds almost like an organizational equivalent of a modern technical architecture with a platform and sort of quite standalone modules with some APIs that communicates in fairly standardized ways, and you can sort of run it like that. When you create this common or shared foundation, this is possibly a source of excellence and cost efficiency and reuse and learning and these things. But I guess it also introduces new interdependencies that to some extent limits the autonomy of the different units. Do you see any of those things playing out?
Yeah, in a way. But the thing is, in a digital world, everything is about scale, and the raw material is data. And we have, with the regulations there are now, in order for us to share data across, we have had to make Schibsted the data owner. And you need to structure that data in a similar way to be able to efficiently share it across. And the value of that is so immense that it supersedes any sort of cost you might have of standardizing. So it hasn't been very conflictual, because there are such clear use cases of the benefit of belonging or having and belonging to this foundation. And then just to finish that picture off, we shape this as a pyramid with a foundation at the bottom and then all the different autonomous brands. And then at the top, we have something common again, and that's our purpose. And that is that, we have a vision of, building societies with trust and transparency. And we, our mission is that we empower people in their daily lives. And actually, all these different brands and all the different things we do can all find a commonality in that purpose. And I think that ties it all together in the other end, in a way.
And that is an interesting aspect that you both see in on a team level with autonomous teams, but also on a corporate level, like you explain, that if you grant people or groups or businesses autonomy, in order to make that not a chaos but a somewhat organized community, and people need to have a shared picture of the future, some shared values, and some kind of a common map. So when they go out and explore, they do it in a somewhat coordinated fashion, because they carry some of those codes on the inside, right?
Yep.
But just to follow up on this duality, which I think many of the listeners will be very curious to hear more about. And you used the first example about 100 years of legacy, and then in a very fast-changing environment. What's the culture, and how do you achieve being able to do both, to keep a part of the legacy and at the same time adapt to, let's call it, exponential world? What's the drivers? How do you as a CEO or management team work on this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like we kept the legacy as such. It's not like one part of Schibsted is really old-fashioned and other parts are really modern. It's not like that. I mean, we've all modernized. And the media part, which is the legacy, right, 180 years old, they have been through the toughest transitions of all, I think, with the, you know, because digitalization hit really early. But you can also imagine that the reach that we had in media and our ability to digitalize media early, that is really the foundation of having built all these other businesses. You know, we spun out marketplaces, realizing we were not in a paper classifieds business, but that was going to move online. And we disrupted ourselves when we launched Finn, and we let Finn compete fiercely with Aftenposten, really attacking our key cash cow. And very few companies are able to really do that, because some companies say that they're going to challenge themselves, but they don't really, because in the end they are, after all, defensive of that cash cow. But we really did it, and we killed Aftenposten's classifieds revenue, but we built Finn, which is now worth so many times more than Aftenposten would ever be. So, you know, so media has also been part of that disruption, if you see my point, and has been a vehicle for building all these new businesses.
But I presume that it was not easy and to kill that cash cow, and I presume or assume that there was a lot of resistance within the organization.
Absolutely. And this was in the year 2000, right after the dot-com crash, if you remember the dot-com boom and then crash. And everyone who had been believing in all the e-somethings at the time, you know, all these different efforts people were making online, were considered complete idiots. And just in that environment, where many companies retrieved their digital undertakings because of that failure, so to say, Schibsted realized that boom and bust was a passing phase, and the underlying trend was the digitalization of media that was going to change it forever. And we often estimate how quickly it happens, and then we underestimate how profound the change is in the end. And that's exactly what happened to us as well. But my predecessors at Schibsted realized that, and they really forced a strong disruption in Finn and let Finn be completely autonomous. And it was controversial. You should start selling ads on Finn for 1,500 kroners instead of full page ads in the paper for 150,000 kroners. It made no sense at the time. But they really foresaw the future and realized what they had to do back then in order to position themselves. And 3-4 years later, when everybody realized it was smart to be online, those positions were taken. And it's been very hard to challenge ever since, because the digital world is a very sort of network-based logic where the one who has the strong gravity in that network is really hard to challenge. It's hard to challenge Google on search. It's hard to challenge Facebook on social media.
Is it like winner takes it all?
Exactly. And it's hard to challenge Finn on classifieds.
But continue on this topic on innovation, experimentation. You will not always get it right. There is certain firms who claim that we even celebrate failures just to encourage that people need to try and learn from it. How far do you go to encourage, not encourage failure, but kind of accept that we have to also do failures to have some successes?
Yeah. I mean, there is acceptance for that. And we have made also many, we talk about the brilliant things we did, but of course, we along the way, we did lots of things that failed and cost us a lot of money. Of course, we did that. And maybe, or at least, you know, people in Schibsted, you don't get sacked for it. But I don't know, I think it would be an exaggeration to say that we celebrate it, but we acknowledge that that's part of the game. And another thing we do is that we do what we call retrospectives. When we do things that go wrong, we try to do an organized process of analyzing what happened. And when something goes wrong, it's not because everything was wrong. Maybe the strategy was right, but we didn't execute in the right way. Or maybe the timing was wrong. Or maybe, you know, there are always like different factors. And it's important to understand why things fail and then learn from that.
Exactly.
And in all failures, there are always good successes too. I mean, some things were done really well, but it still failed.
Yeah. So it's the feedback loop and the learnings from all initiatives being good or less good in the sense of successful or less successful.
Yes.
But I guess that's, Vega, something also you are have research and teaching. And I think actually I have heard you saying to your students that old-fashioned strategic planning is something we don't do anymore. We do only experimentation. Or is that right?
Well, it's almost right. I mean, the planning approach to strategy makes sense if the world is predictable and you know what you need to know when you make the plan. And increasingly, that is not the case. So we have to approach it differently, right? So in some settings, then planning is actually potentially quite dangerous because it gives you a false sense of security.
Yeah, and you get stuck in the wrong plans.
Right. And what you just described, Christine, I think is a great example of what I call, a strategy as disciplined experimentation. If we sort of move away from the planning mindset and apply, let's say, the scientific method, and not think about strategy as a plan, but as a set of hypotheses that we continuously develop and test, then we have a much more dynamic and more learning-oriented and more adaptive approach to strategy. And in a way, as researchers, we deliberately seek out the spaces that we are partly ignorant about. That we need to know more about and having discipline in doing that. And it's so much better to do a controlled experiment than to do all these big bets where the consequences of going wrong are so big. And I mean, just look at public, IT projects or something. That the fast and more adaptive one is a way to manage risk, actually. And I remember I read a piece by somebody in Finn about their development method, which is called in Norwegian snuden, or the swirl or something, which talks about exactly that you experiment in order to manage risk. Because when there's uncertainty, you need to test in order to know. And then, of course, scale whatever works. And adapt or just cancel the stuff that doesn't work. And I think that is a very different mindset than the sort of engineering, inspired planning type of approach. We need to develop some new disciplines, a new way to run companies in order to, how do we develop new hypotheses? How do we develop new insights, generate these ideas, and how we turn them into effective experiments? And how do we learn from both the ones that give us the desired result and, as you talk about, the ones that are not giving us the desired result? Because ultimately, the purpose of an experiment is to learn something that might lead to higher performance. And sharing those insights is important, both, when there are pluses and minuses.
Yeah, I have this, I have a success formula that I've used ever since I was young, and it's called 5-15-80. And I say that when you look at companies actually trying to do the same thing, some succeed and some don't. And how come? What is it? And I say that only 5% can be attributed to a good strategy and plan, because like you said, you can get stuck in it. You can copy plans, you can change them, or they can end up in the drawer, right? And then 15% is position. It's, it's a strength to have a strong brand, good people, capital, whatever it is. But positions can get lost. We've seen that. And more importantly, positions can make you defensive and want to protect rather than to explore new opportunities. So that's why I put it as low as 15. And then 80% is about execution. And, really all major part of success has to do with your ability to execute. And when we constantly create new products and concepts, there is an element of unpredictability in that. You can't analyze your way into what's going to fly in a consumer world. You have to, there's an element of art in it. you know, and, you know, design and user friendliness and frictionlessness and all these different things. And you can't decide it. You have to, you know, feel your way to it and experiment your way to success somehow. And I also see in our people that some of them really have that in their, in them. They just understand, you know, it, almost like who makes a good film and who doesn't, you know, it's an element of art. And you need to set that free. You can never try to structure that too much because then you won't find it.
So if strategic planning is less important, at least in some settings, does that go with strategic thinking as well? Or is that more ubiquitous across, you know, all kinds of units, all kinds of levels?
Yeah, and I mean, take, for example, media as an example. It's part of our strategic planning to realize that audio and live pictures will become, you know, very important supplements to our originally very text-based media publications. So, for example, within audio, we now have a big undertaking in podcasts. And that's a part of a strategic plan and thinking that we are launching a podcast offering. But what you fill that with must be, you know, handled in this more, let's say, artistic free way, autonomous way. And you must leave that to the people who know how to do that the best.
That's why I'm very happy that you're joining our podcast.
So
we one step ahead.
Maybe so much art in this one, but
well, actually, we're discussing within in academia the balance between art and science. That's always a discussion, and as you know, I'm come from the practical world, moving into academia, so I'm trying to find that balance myself. But you know, the execution part is like quoting Jack Welch is all about execution. But I'm kind of curious to follow on your topic. It's about innovation. Is it decentralized within each unit, and how do you kind of accumulate the common knowledge of those either experiments or innovation? How do you do that systematically?
Well, the thing is, you can't really decide innovation. You know, you can't tell somebody innovate, and you can't say that this group, this team over here, you know, that's our innovation team. They'll innovate and the rest of us will just run the business. That's not how it is. Innovation is everywhere, and you have to empower everybody and really institute into every single employee that innovation is the responsibility of every single person here, no matter what you do. And you are not just to fill your role, you are to shape it and expand the horizon of the role and the products and the whatever you do, the features that you are responsible for. And the power of that attitude and all those, you know, small and sometimes big innovations and improvements is always larger than something you can command from the top. And one of my favorite examples of innovation in Schibsted is actually our newspaper distribution, because in 2013, we thought the newspaper would be dead by 2017. And a new person, Katrine, she came in from the Norwegian Post, and she was basically tasked with dismantling this distribution over time. And she said, well, you know, she thought to herself, well, we can, of course, choose to be in a declining newspaper business, or we can choose to be in a growing e-commerce distribution business. And she was the one who took the initiative to Helt Hjem and to Morgenlevering and these super successful products. And today, it's the fastest growing part of Schibsted is actually our distribution. And all these old newspaper distributors are now have a much more complex job distributing parcels and breakfast and, you know, flowers and whatnot. And I think that's a fantastic story. The maybe most legacy part of all of Schibsted newspaper distribution is the fastest growing part of Schibsted today. And it's such a great example of rethinking your position. You know, what's really the value of the positions we have? Well, our value is that we are 90% of doormats every morning. That's a fantastic strategic asset to build from. And it just goes to show that if we were to decide innovation, we probably wouldn't have thought of newspaper distribution for being a hub for it. But it is.
Exactly.
And you need to empower those people to be their own innovators. And that's when it works. I don't think anyone from the top management team would have thought of that, but they did.
But how do you then practically encourage such entrepreneurship, agility, creativity?
Talk about it all the time. And show the ones who succeed, you know, and make, you know, good role models and, you know, encourage people to always challenge and always think bigger than themselves.
What's your reflection on this, Vegard?
First of all, it's very inspiring, and I think it's a great example. And I think in a big organization, there are typical forces for you know, conserving things and making fixed structures and these things and sort of avoiding mistakes because of the scale, you know, the mistakes tend to be big and all these things. And then actually to keep and to nurture this more exploration-oriented mindset is something that requires work all the time. And I think you just describe that beautifully, and there are certain things we can organize. We can certainly organize these things away, make it very difficult. But to create these things is not something, you know, the organization design will do by itself. I mean, it can stop it, or it can enable it, but it's the people in it, and I think that is maybe one of the most important part of management in a setting where there's a lot of autonomy. How do you create that type of culture that encourage that experimentation and new ideas and give them room to grow?
Yeah. But you're right. And we also do something a bit more structured. For example, VG is a very innovative company.
VG.
And they have something called VG Lab, and where they actually do gather some people and let them experiment a lot. And they come up with new concepts, which sometimes is then spun off as a separate entity. Sometimes Schibsted, as the mother, will take over and run it. And sometimes it will be integrated into a broader VG offering. But they have maybe a more, one of the companies who have a more structured approach to some of it. Doesn't mean that not everybody in VG has an innovative mindset, but they have actually, you know, this concept of a lab where they experiment.
But can you say that some of these innovation, and you know, you used VG as an example, or many of these media papers have had to change because they have been on a burning platform, that actually has kind of fueled or encouraged that we have to, otherwise we have no future. Do you need to have a burning platform, or was that a help for you to have that burning platform to kind of accelerate that change?
Yeah, I think so. But then again, we were really early out in digitalizing media before it burnt, to put it that way. And so I think that was foresight, because that was understanding this long-term trend and what was about to hit us, and that we needed to be positioned in that before it hit, right? Before it started burning. Mm. So, you know, VG was launched digitally, way over 20 years ago, and was already really strong in the late 90s. It was already a quite strong digital brand. So we were early, but of course that the fact that then Google and Facebook came and took most of the ad money away, for example, has forced a very strong discipline of transformation, no doubt about it.
We all talk about speed of change, and I think we all feel it, regardless where you are in the society. And there is a claim that the speed of change has increased. Is it your experience, and do you think it will continue to increase, or will we keep? How are you looking to the future now?
Sometimes I can get a bit dystopic about it, because I think, oh my God, everything is changing so fast, and how am I going to understand what's going to happen, and how am I going to have this foresight? And you can sometimes get a bit sort of frightened about it all. But then you have to just, you can't think that way. You just have to, keep confident, have faith, and you need to just work on it. Like, we're doing a huge project in Schibsted now called the Horizon, where we are working with an American Future Institute, and we are making future scenarios. And it's super interesting, because we're just trying to imagine everything. And of course, not all of that is going to happen, but you need to have quite a broad funnel of scenarios in order to act upon it. And we do see some main trends of things we just need to relate to and understand today. Sustainable consumption is a trend that's obviously going to happen. And how is that really going to affect us? You know, the need for digital, secure digital identities and product tracking, product passports, all of these verification things that's going to augment. What is that going to do to us? What do we need to do today to be positioned for that future? So, and I could mention many, many examples of that. So that's how we work with it, to try to to let's say, structure our foresighting somehow, or let's say our scenario thinking.
So basically look at some mega trends and see how it may or may not impact the way you operate your business lines.
And try to understand, you know, the quite broad possible future outcome that these trends will bring. And then, you know, you try to narrow it down to what's the most essential things today to be best positioned for that.
That's an interesting transition to some of the things you have studied, Vegard, is the way we now, as humans, employees, manage to integrate more and more with data, information, AI, and that combination between machine learnings and the way we take decision as managers or employees. What's your take here now?
Well, I think, you know, Kristin, you have more, you know, more practical experience in this, but the, some of the patterns that we see is, first of all, organizational learning includes both human and machine learning. And we think we need to think holistically about that. And if you look in organizations, who's doing the work? It's basically people and technology. What do managers have to know about and care about? People and technology. And I think, you know, the time where we could say, you know, I don't need to know technology because our IT department is so great, is just as silly as saying, I don't need to know how to treat people because HR is so great. I mean, it's basically both things. It doesn't have to make us into psychologists or engineers or both, but I mean, some interest there. And then in order to make decisions and establish good practices based and informed on data, I think managers need to know the basics of analytics, because how do you recognize a problem where data can help you give the answer? How do you recognize quality and potential issues when you're presented with various types of analyses? And a number of these things, and how do you talk to data scientists? I think managers need to be bilingual. So you have to be able to speak tech and to speak people, and of course, sort of the domain of the business. So I think that is important. And then, you know, looking at what can technology help us with, and where do we need people? And generally, it's those things that require judgment, the things that require experience, expertise, ethical reasoning, empathy, holistic thinking, because these technologies, at least currently, they can be super smart in very narrow domains. And to integrate across and to see the big picture, that is still, and I think for foreseeable future, still sort of the domain of people. So I think that is a big challenge, and I'm curious about, you know, how you build those skills and let's say culture in your management cohort and even sort of on the front lines perhaps.
Yeah. And in addition to what you say, I think it's a really important thing to be able to think in an exponential reality. And you can't just be linear and extrapolate what has been and think that the future is just a bit more and a bit of an improvement of that, because it's not. You know, technology is exponential. And it means you have to have this mindset of that future scenario thinking, and then, you know, you need to foresee the future, and then you need to try to track back, what do I need to do today, rather than just, you know, being a prolongation of what's been. And that is a different mindset. And it's hard for us humans to do that because we are linear by nature. So that's another addition to what you just said. How do you do that? I mean, you have to make sure that you have a super, super good team of managers. We, you know, do not, you know, you have to be super alert to bad management is not allowed, you know, no sort of sins of omittance, as I call it. Like, if you know something is not working, do something about it instantly. Don't let that develop. And organizational coach that has worked with our team said, you know, it takes one drop of poison in a good glass of liquid to ruin everything. And you know, just make sure you never get that poison in anywhere. And that's so important. And you know, because you want psychological safety, you want trust, you want empowerment, you want transparency, you want respect. And under those conditions, people can work and thrive. And you need to make sure that people, you know, I sometimes say that people need to be, you know, to have the right nutrition, because an excellent person can be placed with the wrong surroundings or the wrong nutrition and they won't function optimally. And it's not necessarily something wrong with the person, but you need to make sure that person is set in an environment which is optimal for that person's potential. So, you know, also making sure that you really let people have an opportunity to maximize their potential all the time. And you need a very professional HR department to do this. And you need, and we use a lot of science and technology in HR, and Schibsted hasn't always been that good at it, to be honest, but we have improved a lot, I would say. And we have also, you know, using technology to be much, much better at managing people and their opportunities and detecting also what's not working optimally.
Right. And I think also in terms of, let's say, data-based decision-making, to me, there seems to be two like opposing trends or practices. One being that when you get all these data and all these systems, in some settings, you get much more centralized decision-making because you can gather all the information and you think you can process it and then sort of make collective decisions. The other trend, which seems to be more like what you're advocating or describing, is that, well, with these systems, with all this data, we can provide potentially every employee with insights and analytical superpowers so they can make informed decisions, they can treat customers well, they can, you know, innovate, they can do all these things. But it seems like the same technologies can be used for extreme centralization and potentially extreme decentralization. Do you see those things play out in Schibsted? It seems like the way you're arguing, you know, is towards sort of spreading the knowledge and the insight, but...
Yeah, but it depends what you mean by centralization, because there is a centralization happening in the sense that a larger portion of Schibsted today is working actually in Schibsted. For example, everyone in product and tech work in the foundation, which is Schibsted. Every HR person is employed in Schibsted. Despite being placed out in one of the brands and working for one of the brands, because we want to manage that holistically in the foundation.
Right.
But I don't know if that's necessarily felt as a centralization, because those people are still working super close to the brands, and they are seen as belonging to the brands, but it is a centralization still. So again, I guess you're back to the duality.
Yeah.
How do you benefit from the scale without making it an exercise of centralization? Do you see my point?
Yeah. So you get a different blend of, let's say, freedom and fellowship in the company, or autonomy and alignment. I mean, there you try to find the shared common elements and exploit the possibilities and the potential and the benefits of being big and sharing, and then sort of the adaptiveness of specializing and being relatively independent in some of the domains.
Would an employee on average who works at Finn, say he or she works at Finn or at Schibsted?
Finn.
Okay,
definitely.
So definitely.
And many of them would feel that Schibsted is quite distant to them.
Yeah, even though they're a formal employee.
Their employer is Finn. I mean, they're on their contract, they would say Finn. Yes, but Finn is owned by Schibsted, and they are part of Schibsted, and many of their colleagues, or some of the colleagues that they interact with all the time, will actually be employed by Schibsted and not Finn. But there's a very, very strong identity around the brands.
Yeah, I can imagine. What would you look for when many of your brands are recruiting students now? And what's the advice for us? How should we prepare the students for the future?
Yeah, well, it's a war for talent out there. So it's a good time to be a student, actually, because and especially if you know the slightest thing about technology, you will have a job as soon as you raise your hand, basically. But you know what we see or and what we look for, again, back to people who can challenge us, who can come in with new views, new ideas. We are not really looking for people who will just be sort of soaked in and become one of us. We really want, you know, every new employee to be a challenger and to help us improve and shape. So bring their strength and their perspectives to us and not just come to us to be absorbed into what we already are. So we're really looking for that.
Hmm. And that is actually also very much in line with what some interesting labor statistics are showing us. And the short version is that it's the combination of analytical and social skills that is a winner in the labor market overall. So because when all this technology is taking over all the routine work, we end up doing more problem solving and it's more complex, so we have to work together in order to do it. Mm-hmm. So even though we work more analytically, we also have to work more socially or collaboratively. Yeah. And these things actually are connected and these are not opposite.
Yes.
Mutually reinforcing. So the study of Deming 2017 is a great one. So read it.
Yeah, well,
that was a fine ending. I can see we could continue a long time on this conversation, but I must say, very impressed what you've been able to achieve and ships have done for 180 years, and you continue on that traction in a fast-changing environment. Some very interesting observation, advice, and guidance for us going forward. So thank you very much for your time and all the best going forward. And thank you, Vegard, for your contribution. And for listeners, I hope you enjoyed this series. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.